Okay, let us begin. Okay, everyone, hello. This is our third class dealing with Herb Elchanan Wasserman. There's a lot to do, as you've seen, so let's get right into it. Although before I do, I want to respond to every week a couple of comments from previous classes. So let me begin just with this, and then we'll get right to it. Just two things which relate to last semester dealing with the Ben Ish Chai. I was reading this book, which I'll have more to say about as we get through this semester when we deal with Rav Avadia Yosef, the middle years. It's the secretary or assistant's diary from Rav Avadia Yosef, all different things. And it reminded me of something about the Ben Ish Chai that I should have mentioned, which I didn't. And truthfully, Rav Avadia mentions this in his response as well. And that's that the Ben Ish Chai has a very interesting position. He says that it's permitted for women to kiss the hands of the rabbi. You've seen the men in the Sephardic world, how they go, they kiss the hand, that's how they do it, almost like they kiss the Pope's ring. I mean, in the Sephardic world, you go, you kiss the hand like that, something that Ashkenazim are not accustomed to doing that, even when you go before a Sephardic rabbi. And so he discusses, I don't want to get into it now, but this was the Ben Ish Chai's position, that you don't have to worry about a rabbi having improper thoughts and everything, that a woman can kiss his hand. And what the man who records, it's a diary, what he records of Avadia saying is that he finds it shocking that this could have been permitted, and it must be that the Ben Ish Chai was a Malach Kadosh Elyon, that he was so pious that it never could have occurred to him that this would have been a problem. Obviously today we know that would be a problem. You can't even have, I don't even know if you should have men doing it in what we've seen in the last few years, but that's of interest. And if anyone wants to see Rav the Ben Ish Chai inside, send me an email and I'll send you the exact source. The other thing also from Rav Avadia Yosef I wanted to call your attention to is that we spoke last semester about this practice that according to the halacha, without dispute, basically, with almost little exception, technically you can have a non-Jewish orchestra or band or whatever play for you Friday night at a wedding or a celebration after a wedding. I guess the Sheva Brachos also, something that if you told the average person that this was permissible, or if you said you're having a Sheva Brachos and you're going to be having non-Jews play for you, they'll think you're Reform. But this is explicit already back in the commentaries on the Shulchan Aruch. I also quoted for you that Rav Eliezer Melamed from Har Bracha, who has a very interesting works on Jewish law. They're like practical, like a Shulchan Aruch, with commentary of his own and very, very helpful works. They call it, he calls it Pnine Halacha. And I read to you last semester how he explained why today, despite the fact that this is permitted, today we don't permit it. Then he gave all sorts of reasons. And I assumed that that was basically the standard position, but I was learning during the break between last semester and this semester this one, Chazon Ovadia, which is Rav Avadia Yosef's final works. That is, he began with his responsa. I guess you have the Yalkut Yosef, which reflects his positions, and you have the Chava Dat, the Abiya Omer, and this is really the final work. So anything in this work supersedes other things. And in the Laws of Shabbat, Volume 5, page 271, he begins by saying that at a Simcha for Chatan and Kala, you can't dance. So therefore, you can't. By the way, I don't know who has access to a microphone, but someone I think has a microphone on, and I'm hearing it come back to me. So, or maybe technical support. Maybe you have access to it, and you can make sure everyone's off. He begins by saying that you can't dance on Shabbos. Now, this is an issue that Ashkenazim we do dance on Shabbos, based upon already opinion of Tosos, but Sfardim don't generally, or then according to Rav Avadia, they're not supposed to. And then he says that you can clap if you clap in a bit of a different way. And then he says it's permitted to tell a non-Jew to play an instrument. And he explains it's a shvut to shvut, and you're allowed to b'mkom mitzvah. So here Rav Avadia paskens halacha lamaaseh, that you can have non-Jew playing an instrument for you on Shabbat. Okay, let's pick up where we were. One more thing. He's not with us, but Slonimsky, if you remember from last class, Chaim Zelig Slonimsky, that's obviously a pseudonym. He took issue with something I said. It wasn't my own. I was repeating what Aaron Sarosky says in his biography. Aaron Sarosky says that Rabbi Chanan did not... he's going through different pseudonyms. Now he's Yaakov Reifman. I didn't look down and see that there was Yaakov Reifman. Next week, maybe he'll be Shmuel David Rotsato, and after that, Shlomo Yehuda Rappaport. We'll have to wait. But Aaron Sarosky claims that Rabbi Chanan, although he's a student of Rabbi Chaim Soloveitchik, did not adopt the analytic approach, and he disagrees. He gives many sources where Rabbi Chaim is quoted. Obviously, Sarosky would agree that Rabbi Chaim is quoted. The question is, do you find in his Chidushim Brisker type analysis? And I will take Yaakov Reifman's word if he says it's there. I haven't gone through the Kovet Shiurim, and I'm just relying on what Sarosky says. And truth be told, I don't think Sarosky's gone through the Kovet Shiurim. He's basically a Haredi historian. He's not a traditional Talmud Chacham. Yaakov Reifman also mentioned something about Ratzi Yehuda's cook about Rabbi Chanan, but I'll get to that at the end of the semester. Okay, let us pick up. We have a lot to do today, a lot of interesting things to do today. I want to finish up what we were doing last time and then move into the Aguda Convention of 1937. What I want to begin, though, with something that Moshe called my attention to last week. He reminded me of a letter that appears in this volume. I didn't remember it, even though I was citing things direct on both sides of it. A letter from Rabbi Elchanan Wasserman to this man you're looking at, Jacob Rosenheim. Who was Jacob Rosenheim? Well, he was in Frankfurt. He was the head of the World Agudas Yisrael. He was not a rabbi, although he looks like a rabbi. He was a layperson. He leaves Germany and then comes to America, and then leaves Germany before the war, comes to America, then goes to Israel. But an important person, he's really the equivalent of what in America Rabbi Moshe Scherer was. Moshe Scherer was a rabbi. He had smicha, but he didn't function as a rabbinic figure. He was the head of Agudas Yisrael in America, and that was really Yaakov Rosenheim's role. Although he's often called rabbi, he wasn't, and the Agudas Yisrael gave him a honorary title. They called him Morenu. So you can call him Morenu Harav because of all the good work he did. Now, we ended last class discussing this controversy over Avodah Ivrit, hiring Jewish workers in the land of Israel, even if they would be more expensive, and Rabbi Chanan Wasserman's opposition to this for a variety of reasons. What Moshe reminded me of is that in the first volume of the collected articles and letters, there is a letter to Yaakov Rosenheim, a lengthy letter, in which Rabbi Chanan explains his position, which, as we saw, is against the viewpoint of the Chazon Ish, against the viewpoint of Rav Chaim Ozer. Rav Chaim Ozer didn't have a position, and he didn't think that any rabbi in Chutz La'aretz should have a position. His position, and the position of the Moetzes Gedolei Torah of the Aguda, was that this should be left to the rabbis in the land of Israel. And we saw how Rav Reuven Katz was so upset with Rav Chanan, and the Poli Aguda were very upset. So this is the letter, and he says a number of things. Let me just call your attention to the highlights of it. He says, he responds to the idea that the Poli Aguda and others had said that, fine, according to maybe strict halacha, you can't require, someone could hire whoever he wants to hire, but we know that the rabbis have the authority to make takanot, make ordinances, and state that you can only hire Jews. The Jews were charging three times as much, you couldn't, but they're allowed to make ordinances that require you to hire Jews to a certain amount, as long as you're not paying too much, because then the people won't listen. But it's no different than any other tax that the rabbis declare or anything like that. And Rabbi Chanan replies that that's correct, but that applies when the rabbis are doing it. But this idea that you have to hire Jews, this comes from organizacja. That is the the Histadrut is making this rule, and are we going to say that the Histadrut can make takanot? So he says it's nonsense. I don't know. I mean, it's not that the point of the rabbis were that the Histadrut was saying this, but the rabbis agreed with it. So if the rabbis agreed with what the Histadrut was saying, so the Poalei Aguda, the religious workers, are not being bound by the Histadrut. They're being bound by the fact that the rabbis agree with the Histadrut. So it's no different than it's a takana of the rabbis. I find this a very weak argument he makes. Then he continues. He says a number of things. The most important for our purposes is that he says that he's not blaming the workers who got into this whole avodah ivrit, Hebrew labor thing, because they're anashim peshutim. They're just simple people, and they don't know much. He says yediyatam b'Torah, it's not very much. He's saying that I'm criticizing those who are who know better, and I'm criticizing those who are telling them that they're doing good. That is the rabbis who are saying to the workers, what you're doing is correct. That is, you're putting on all this pressure on the owners that they should only hire Jewish workers, when instead they should have told them shehem osim shelo kadin. They should have said they're not doing correct. And then you get into the interesting paragraph. He says, who came up with this idea to have workers' organizations? We never heard of this before. He says that they're going in the path of the Bolsheviks. That is, this is a communist idea that the Jews have adopted. So you're going to see already from this that the workers' parties, which was a socialist party, are not going to be very well inclined to Rabbi Chanan, because basically he's saying that they have to disband their organizations. He's opposed to unions. And this is already an issue in 19th century Russia, where the rabbis were aligned with the business people. And we even have statements where the rabbis condemned the workers for striking and told them to go back to work. So this idea that the workers had, where you had this unholy alliance between the economic elites and the rabbis, something which, by the way, goes back to the Chopper era, when the economic leadership was aligned with the rabbis, and they kidnapped the rabbis, turned a blind eye to allow the rich people, when they had to come up with children to supply for the military, they kidnapped the poor people. So you already had negative feelings about the rabbis, and here, I mean, from the workers' perspective, the job of a union is simply to protect the workers' interests, and they don't see themselves as communists. These are religious Jews. But Rabbi Chanan sees it as an infiltration of Bolshevism. And the problem is the Poalim Haksharim, Lonim Maaseihem, they're learning, they're adopting the Bolshevik perspective. And then he says, Ha'im ra'oi v'hagun agonhu l'hachasik b'torat ha-Bolshevikim? Are we supposed to be supporting Bolshevik tactics here? We have a Torah. Okay, so and you can read more if you want the letters. And finally he said the letter. He responds to the fact that he was criticized for putting all the workers into one pile, that they're irreligious. And here we're talking about religious workers. And he says, I don't mean to criticize all the workers from a religious standpoint, although he criticizes them from another standpoint. He says, but the leadership, Rov Minyan Ubinyan, the majority of the Histadrut, these are irreligious people and anti-religious people, and therefore it's forbidden for Jews to have any involvement with this. Very strong. Let us move on then to where we were. Okay. As I said, Rav Chaim Ozer Grudzinski did not. Let me say goodbye to Yaakov Rosenheim here. We're going to come back to Yaakov Rosenheim in a little bit because he ran the convention that we're going to talk about. But let me pull up Rabbi Chanan's picture again. Rav Chaim Ozer also did not accept, as I said, Rabbi Chanan's opinion. And you can find Rav Chaim Ozer Grudzinski's letter a couple different places. And the easiest is probably in this work, which is collected writings of the Chazon Ish that came out. This is volume 4 that came out a year or two ago. And here you have the letter on page 103, where he writes to the Chazon Ish about the issue that we're speaking. Well, the issue he writes about, should Paul go to Cicero? He's not, I'm sorry, he's not speaking here about the issue of workers. He's speaking about the other issue that we spoke about. We ended actually last class about separate communities. Rabbi Chanan says it's forbidden to be in the larger community. And what Rabbi Chaim Ozer here is writing to the Chazon Ish is about the question the Poalei Aguda Yisrael wanted to know if they could participate in elections in Tel Aviv. That is, could they be part of the community? or do they need to separate? And why were they going to do that? Because they wanted to put in their leadership. And this is what Reb Chaim Ozer says. We already saw last class the position of Rabbi Chana Wasserman. It's absolutely forbidden. Reb Chaim Ozer says, I'll read it in Hebrew. Be'emet da'ati note ladat hadrat go'no shenirim hadvarim achizuk hayadot kamo shenogim begola. He says, I agree with you, Chazonish, that this is a positive thing, and they're doing exactly what's done in the diaspora. As we mentioned last class, in Poland and Lithuania, every single city in Poland and Lithuania, the Orthodox Jews voted in this, in the elections together with the irreligious. And that's, I read you last class, that was Rabbi Chanan Wasserman wrote to Rabbi Chanan. How does this differ from what's happening right now in Poland and Lithuania? And I read you what Rabbi Chanan's reply was. But Rabbi Chaim Ozer says that this is what they should do. But then he says, but if you're gonna, if there's gonna be concern that, you know, Agudas Yisrael in Jerusalem was a very different, and in the land of Israel as a whole was a very different organization than in Europe. And I'll read you later what it says in Hapardes journal about this. He says, if this is going to negatively affect the Agudas Yisrael's striving for a separate community, that is, there was in Jerusalem in particular, you had the Aguda elements who wanted this separate community. Rabbi Chaim Ozer says, if the fact that Poalei Agudas Yisrael, which is a part of Agudas Yisrael, is actually voting as a unit and encouraging its members to vote, if this is going to hurt the efforts of the Aguda in Jerusalem, who are appearing before the British High Commissioner and asking him to have a separate community, then he says that, first of all, Rabbi Chaim Ozer says, I don't know exactly, I don't know about all these political things, but he says that perhaps the best thing to do would to vote not in the name of Poalei Aguda, but everyone, kol achad yishtatef b'chirot. Everyone should individually vote, but don't make it a call from the Poalei Aguda. But he doesn't see any issue, and similar to what we spoke about. Now, in this book, a new letter is published by Rabbi Chanan, and that you find it on page 104 and 105. And this is, I mean, again, very, very strong and very harsh. He writes to the Chazon Ish, and on page 105, he says, the Chazon Ish had said, as you recall, that you have rabbis, you know, tzaddikim, who are leading their communities, they're in the general community, and this really, there's no relevance. All they do is supply the names of the people, and there's no interference whatsoever. What Chanan again says that, they need to, it's forbidden for them to be connected with them. And don't tell me that, if you tell me that there's B'nai Adam HaMachunim Rabbanim, if you tell me that there's people called rabbis, I mean, that's not how the Chazon Ish referred to them. He referred to them very positively as tzaddikim. He says, if they have sold themselves, you know, basically to the devil, if they have sold themselves to this, these parties, Elef Kayotze Behem Yibatlu. He says, let 1,000 of them, we don't care about. We're standing up for Torah. So if you have 1,000 rabbis who sell themselves to the Zionists, that doesn't matter. This is the exact same language used by the Eda Charedit to this very day. You know, you point out there's all these great Talmid HaChachamim involved in the Rabbanut. They simply say, another 1,000 who've sold themselves to the idol of idolatry of Zionism. That was the exact same language used in 1948 as well. And it's very difficult language, and that's why very few bought it. But that's the language Rabbi Chanan uses here. Finally, you have on page 105 an interesting document from the Chazon Ish, where the Chazon Ish, although he supported those rabbis who were involved in the general community, and he didn't see any obligation to separate, what you have here is that he agrees. In 1943, when an Agudist figure began working to get permission to have a separate community of the Aguda with its own separate Beit Din that wouldn't be involved in the general Beit Din, it says that the Chazon Ish did support this. It's hard to know what that means, did support it. What it means is that he told him, I mean, he said that this is a good thing, but that doesn't mean that he said that it's forbidden to be in the general community, but he did tell him it's a good thing and he supported it and wrote letters that this should be permitted, that in Germany it was a good thing for there to be a separate community because the community then has to be more pious because they're afraid that the Orthodox are going to leave the general community. So we have this document that the Chazon Ish definitely supported the establishment of a separate community. He never said that you're obligated to join a separate community. And I'm assuming his logic is from freedom of conscience, first of all, if the Aguda wants to have a separate community, that could be a very good thing. Not just for the Aguda, it could also be a good thing for the general community, because it's always good to have someone to your right, on the right wing, making things, keeping you honest. So that's how I think we need to understand the Chazon Ish. But once the State of Israel was established, although the Chazon Ish, he showed respect to Amram Blau and the Naturei Karta, he also was the guide for the Aguda, and Aguda did not adopt this position. It never adopted the separatist position. What happened was that the Yed HaCharedit, which was the Aguda in Jerusalem, they ended up breaking with the Agudas Yisrael precisely because the Aguda refused to adopt the separatist position. We'll get back to that position as well, issue as well. Before we move on to the Aguda convention, I want to read you something that appears here in the Art Scroll book on Rabbi Yochanan. And I think, again, it's another example that you're going to find it very difficult for me to read this to you. And you can only imagine what the response was when he said it years ago, and especially knowing what's going on today, every single day in the land of Israel. This is going to be difficult for me to read. And I'm a little surprised, by the way, that Art Scroll included it because they did take out the other things. But it's important to know, to understand the position. In 1936, no, it's not 36, I think it's 1934, there were pogroms against Jews by Arabs in the land of Israel. And I want to read you what the Art Scroll biography says. News reached Poland, and this is taken from the Swarovski biography, but it's easier to read the translation. News reached Poland of the pogroms perpetrated by the Arabs against Jews living in Eretz Yisrael. Some wanted to attribute the outrages to various malevolent individuals or other factors. Rabbi Yochanan protested against this obfuscation of the truth. The real cause was the abandonment of the Torah and the desecration of the name of God in the Holy Land. Who is guilty of causing the massacres in the Holy Land? He asked. That's a direct quote. The newspaper writers pontificate that the Mufti is to blame, or the short-sighted policies of the British High Commissioner, or even Italian agents. Everyone is guilty but us. And he goes on to explain that according to our religious teachings, we're the reason why this is happening, because you have Jewish cities that maintain a school from its tax revenues where the non-religious and even anti-religious education is imparted it to the young. We aim to eradicate Judaism, etc., etc. Our entire strength lies in our being the pursued. God forbid that we have become the pursuers. Although the Arabs have murdered dozens of Jews, national education has destroyed thousands of Jewish souls. I mean, Jews are being killed by the Arabs, and the blame is being given for the sins of the Jews. They're causing that. And rather than speaking about murdering dozens of Jews, how about the destruction of thousands of Jews by the irreligious? There's definitely precedent for this type of talk in the past, but while Jews are being killed and the bodies are still warm and blood is spilling, I don't have to tell you that the response to this was outrage. And just as the response today is outrage when people make certain comments in the extreme world, it's, I mean, remember, it was religious Jews being killed as well. But we need to understand that the language you hear sometimes, and the blame, blaming, the irreligious for these things happening, not blaming the Arabs. He says, are we going to blame the Mufti? No, the Mufti is just a tool of God, and God is doing this because of the sins of the wicked ones. This is exactly the sort of thing that is going to cause problems for people, because it's look, I'm not going to lie, I find it very disturbing myself. And you don't have other figures speaking like this. It's just another example of how Rabbi Yochanan stood very much outside the mainstream outlook in these matters. Okay, let's turn now to the Agudas Yisrael Convention of 1937. There just was the Aguda Convention of America last week. They called it the 93rd Agudath Yisrael Convention of America, and it is then, and it is because I found a newspaper clipping from 1952, which gave the number, or 1956, I should say, which I think said the 24th convention. Now, I wrote to the archivist today. If any of you listening can help me, then you could solve my problem. I wrote to the archivist of the Aguda, Moshe Kolodny, because I don't understand something. According to all the documents I have, Agudas Yisrael was only founded in America in the 30s, and the first convention was only 1939. If today is the 93rd annual convention, that's what it says, the 93rd annual convention of Agudas Yisrael in America, that means that the convention started when? In 19. If it's 93rd, so go back to 1925. It goes back to 1922. There weren't any Agudists in America in 1922. Maybe you had a couple families, but I'm not sure how you it could be the 93rd annual convention. If that means in 1922 there were Agudas Yisrael conventions in America, I never heard of such a thing. And if you look at the biography of Eliezer Silver, it says the first conventions, I think it said 39, and there wasn't an Aguda in America in the 20s. So I haven't heard back from the archivist yet, and I don't know. I thought maybe it was a mistake, but when I saw the clipping from 1956, it can't be a mistake. But I don't know what it means, unless today they call it the 93rd annual convention of Agudas Yisrael of America, but they're really tying this into Agudas Yisrael conventions in Europe. And it's actually not the 93rd convention of American Agudas Yisrael. It's actually the 93rd convention, they're calling it of Aguda. But now we're doing it in America. Otherwise, I don't know what sense to make of this. And in any event, there used to not be annual conventions in Europe. They had the Knesset Gedola. It was they didn't have it every year. It was not a very common thing. Yes, if they used to have two per year, but then they wouldn't call it an annual convention. When you say the 93rd annual convention, it implies that it's once a year. It's annual. Otherwise, you say the 93rd convention. Well, I'll wait till Moshe Kolodny to get back to me. Now it's annual. Okay, maybe that's it, that they say the 93rd annual convention, and they're not being precise. They used to have them three or four times a year, and now they're calling it. Okay, could be, although it wouldn't be accurate exactly to call it 93rd annual convention, but maybe that's the answer. But the funny thing was that in 1956, they gave the number. You'd have to have a lot of non-annual conventions before 56, but I'll get back to you when I hear from him. In any event, the in 1937, the third Knesia Hagdola, the International Conference of Aguda, happened, and it took place in Marienbad, Czechoslovakia. Next class, I have a book, but I left it in Scranton. A book came out a couple of years ago. Here, I'll give you the title of it. Called Next Year in Marienbad, The Lost Worlds of Jewish Spa Culture. Marienbad was a great, it's in the Czech Republic today still. It was a great place of the spas. They used to go there to take the cure. Today you can go to Saratoga Springs or other places. Marienbad. And you had much in terms of the Orthodox going there, and you had general, Jewish, non-Jewish people who would go there. You had the convention there. Why they picked Marienbad, I don't know. I mean, the earlier convention was supposed to be in Frankfurt in 1914, never happened. You had a Vienna conference. Why Marienbad? It's sort of it's easy access to people, and they came from all over the world. This was an international convention, and it only happened to what they did this every 7, 8 years. They came from Eretz Yisrael. They came from all over Europe. They came from England. They came from America. Unfortunately, Agudas Yisrael never published an annual report of its conventions. Although the convention was very different than today, it was conducted like a real conference with calls to order and votes and oh, very. Today, if you look at the Agudas Yisrael convention, and by the way, they televised it live on the internet, Aguda. So I guess the great Agudas Yisrael's opposition to the internet has fallen. Since this is the first time that Agudas Yisrael ever broadcast its convention on the internet, so that's I think that's a big thing, although no one's mentioned it, that the Agudas has now accepted the internet. But if you looked at the sessions, it was all like a self-help conference. It was all sermons and how to keep people from going off the derech and all sort of stuff like that. There wasn't anything actual serious in terms of issues of controversy. Nothing. It's just like one long weekend of sermons. That was not the case at the conventions before the war, where you had real issues discussed, and people went back and forth, and it wasn't just a yes show where everyone claps for everyone else. There was real disputes and real arguments, and that was the case, by the way, at the early convention as well. Unfortunately, as I said, we don't have a full report. What we do have are newspaper reports, which give various things in the Yiddish papers, and we have an unbelievably detailed description from the Hebrew journal HaPardes. There was a Rabbi Shmuel Pardes. He was from Poland. He comes to America. He's a rabbi in Chicago, and he publishes this journal HaPardes that you can see it on HebrewBooks.org or Otzer HaChachma, which was the voice of the rabbinic elite in America from the 30s up until the 1980s. It was the voice of Agudas HaRabbanim, which were the East European rabbis of all types, by the way, Aguda and Mizrahi. This was the organization that refused to allow the graduates of Ritz, Rishiva University, before it was Rishiva University, Ritz Elchanan, because they thought that they were not learned enough. They're modern American rabbis who spoke English. That's what led to the creation of the RCA, by the way. Had they been allowed into the Agudas HaRabbanim, they wouldn't have had to do this. And Agudas HaRabbanim used to be a very powerful organization. During World War II, it was greatly involved in rescue. And then by the time you get to the 60s, really, it goes into a steep decline because the younger generation couldn't relate to these old-time European rabbis. But Rabbi Pardes travels to the convention, and he gives us a whole report in two issues, including transcripts of speeches and summaries of what went on. And it is a first-class historical document. It is the only document we have which explains in detail what took place at the Agudas Yisrael convention in Marienbad, especially when it came to the issue of Zionism. Agudas Yisrael today would never allow such a document to be published because it would expose rifts in the organization. But no one had any problem in those days with it. It was expected that it would be discussed. So let me go through this. Before I even go further, though, I want to show you that although this was a journal that today would be called a Haredi journal, that all the great rabbis, including Rabbi Chanan, wrote for it. It had. Let me show you something it has, which today would never appear in a Haredi magazine or newspaper, for that matter. First of all, let me tell you the advertisements are great. Anyone who wants to write the history of American Orthodoxy, you have to use HaPardes. I mean, Jeffrey Gurock wrote A History of American Orthodoxy, came out about 5 years ago. Very nice book. But if I were to write the history, and maybe I will, I don't know, I would write it very differently. I would look at rabbinic history, issues. HaPardes is the number one source to see what was going on in the rabbinic world. So take a look at this advertisement. Let me pull it up for you. Here you have an advertisement for those who read Yiddish can read this. Junket, they called it. It's a form of rennet. I guess they used it for cooking or something. But look who's in the picture. Not only do you have a woman, you have a look at the sleeves on her. They try to tell you that this was never done, but and look, it's under Lukus Hashkacha here. It's under the Hashkacha at the bottom you see of Rabbi Pardes. But here you have a picture from HaPardes, the same issue that I'm dealing with, 1937. Let me get rid of this for a second, and let me pull up the screen here. So you have many pages discussion of the convention. This is in year 11. This is 1937, issue 6, and also issue 7. So let me begin. First of all, as I said, Rabbi Pardes or Shmuel Pardes journeyed to Marienbad for the convention, and he begins by describing the journey, who he went with. He went with two people. One was Rabbi Eliezer Silver, who's the head of the Agudas HaRabbanim and a leading student of Reb Chaim Moshe Gruzinski, later to be head of Agudas Yisrael, although today the Agudas Yisrael does not recognize him. They don't seem to have anything to do with him, and they won't, they don't commemorate him or anything, and I'm not sure exactly why that is. I think the reason, even though he was the founder of Agudas Yisrael in America, I think the reason is because by the 1960s, before his death, Rabbi Eliezer Silver had really diverged, and I should have had a picture of him to put up here, but He really was at odds with the Rosh Yeshiva. If you know what happened in the 1950s, power passed from the hands of the rabbis, the communal rabbis, of which Rabbi Silver was one of them in Springfield and then Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, and it had moved into the hands of the rabbis of the Rosh Yeshiva. And at the end of his life, Rabbi Eliezer Silver was speaking at he was even honored at a Rabbinical Council of America convention. He was more happy, he was more at place at the RCA and at the OU than he was with the Agudas Yisrael because he saw a rising extremism. He refused to sign the letter from the Agudas Yisrael against joining the organizations, the mixed board of rabbis, because he thought this was an attack on Rav Soloveitchik. And so by the end of his life, Rabbi Eliezer Silver was not involved in Agudas Yisrael. And they totally ignore him today, but he was the founder in America. And as I said, he was a big student of Rabbi Chanan Wasserman, and he was going to the convention, as you would expect. They were also joined by Rav Shmuel Greineman. Rav Shmuel Greineman later becomes well known as the brother-in-law of the Chazon Ish. He was at this time the brother-in-law of the Chazon Ish. He was the brother-in-law of the Chazon Ish in Europe, and then he moves to the land of Israel, and then he comes to America, where he's in America for a good 20 years. He's actually the one who publishes the writings of the Chazon Ish. So here, for example, is the volume, the title page of one of the volumes of Chazon Ish published already in Vilna. And look at the bottom where you say it says published by Rav Shmuel Greineman. Chazon Ish was at this time anonymous. So this is Rav Shmuel Greineman. He had he was an Askan in Lithuania. That is, he was involved in Jewish religious matters. He was very close to Rav Chaim Moser Grozinski and particularly close to the Chafetz Chaim. He spent time in the yeshiva in Radin and was very close to the Chafetz Chaim. In fact, after the war, after World War II, where is it? I think I thought I had uploaded here, and I didn't. He publishes the Chafetz Chaim al HaTorah. There's a volume of the Chafetz Chaim's comments on the Torah. And most of what's in this volume is material that Rabbi Greineman personally heard from the Chafetz Chaim. When he came to America, he ran Misefta Tiferes Yerushalayim, the yeshiva that Ramosha Feinstein ends up taking over. He only returns to, actually comes to America in 37, and he returns in 1948 to the land of Israel. So they travel to the convention. Now, there was a few different matters at the convention. When I finish with the Aguda, I'll just show you some of the other matters they discussed. But high on the agenda, actually highest on the agenda. Okay, someone says I'm breaking up. Am I breaking up for anyone else? Nope, okay, this could be if you're Ira G, if you're, and I know who Ira G is, if you're breaking up, it could be if you're wireless, that could be it. Okay, highest on the agenda was what should be the attitude to the Jewish state that's coming. Everyone realized the state was coming. In the classes on Rav Chaim Moser, we spoke about his letters to Rav Herzog, where they were already speaking at this time what to do about, they had this idea, both Rav Chaim Moser and Rav Herzog actually thought it might be possible for Jewish law to become the law of the land. And then you have the issue of Choshen Mishpat that we discussed. How do you punish people? There's no witnesses, that sort of thing. And that was discussion. So everyone knew that some sort of Jewish state was coming, whether it was going to be Jewish autonomy with the British controlling defense, or whether it's going to be an actual state and where it would be. I mean, the particulars were not clear, but that the British actual rule of Jews was going to be coming to an end. Pretty much everyone assumed that. So what should be the response of the Aguda, of the Orthodox world? And what we learned from the report of Rabbi Pardes, the detailed report, is that there were three rabbis. He mentions three rabbis. These were the ones who were, powerful in their responses and who were important rabbis of the rabbinic elite. One of them was Mordechai Rotenberg, who was a member of the Moetzes Gedolei Torah, today entirely forgotten, but I'll get back to him later. The other two were Rabbi Chanan and Rabbi Aaron Cutler. And these three were arguing that Agudas Yisrael should not support a state. We already saw that Rabbi Chaim Ozer was convinced that a state was coming, and that if you were not involved with it now, you would not have any chance to influence it when it was established. But Rabbi Chanan and Rabbi Aaron Cutler, and I think that says something about Rabbi Aaron Cutler, because in many ways, Rabbi Aaron Cutler represented, even when he came to America, I've written about this on the Sfarim blog, that the model of Lithuania society, not the yeshivas, but Lithuanian society, is represented much more by what's going on in Baltimore, near Yisrael. The model that Rav Aaron Cutler built was an extreme model, even in Lithuania. That's not how the Lithuanian Jewish community lived. And we spoke about that in the past. I don't want to get back to it. But let me read you something that talks about the opposition from Rav Aaron Cutler and Rabbi Chanan Wasserman. Again, anti-Zionist, arguing that Agudas Yisrael should oppose the creation of the state. That is, it should remain in British hands. And the argument is going to be, the main argument, we already saw it in previous classes, was this great fear that the Zionists would persecute the religious. But I want to begin with, actually, with not with issue six, which is the first issue. He dealt with this in two issues. Issue seven of Hapardes, year 11, beginning on page 8. He records the different speeches that take place at the convention, goes on for pages, and then you get to the evening of the 16th of Elul, 1937, so the summer. He tells us that the Gedolei HaTorah, the great rabbis, and he was a member of this group, that is, he was in there. You had meetings, as we'll see, which were in the large halls in which there were speeches for journalists and for the masses. Then you had times where the great rabbis would have their discussions. And either he was there personally or he had a report about this from Rabbi Eliezer Silver. He says, so they get together to discuss the question of the Jewish state and to make a decision. That is, the great rabbis need to come out with a decision, is Agudah going to support it or not? And it says all the eyes of Israel was looking towards them. And he says that the gathering was stormy. And who participated in the gathering? The Hasidic rebbes of Gur, of Chortkov, of Beyon, of Sadagura, and the great rabbis who were members of the Moetzes Gedolei HaTorah, the organization of the great rabbis of Agudas Yisrael. He says that they went on for 7 hours discussing this. He says there was a great battle at this conference. I mean, if you know the names already and you know about the history, you can anticipate this. For example, the dynasties of Chortkov, Beyon, and Sadagura were always positively inclined to Zionism. So already there you're going to see it. Then he goes on to say that they came up with rulings, not rulings, hachatot, decisions, and we'll read the decisions. And he tells us that they fought over every decision, kotzo shel yud, on every detail of the decisions given. That already shows you that there was compromises. Because the Moetzes Gedolei HaTorah, they fight over this, and then they come out with a decision. And there's going to be compromises made in order to get to the final answer. No one's going to be 100% happy. He tells us that Rav Wasserman, Rav Cutler, and Rav Rothenberg of Amsterdam, the rabbis of Czechin, there's Czechoslovakia, the Ungarn, and Hungary, their opinion was lidcho kohatza al devar hakamat medina yehudit. They opposed creation of the state, and they wanted Agudah to be on record that they opposed the Jewish state. He says the even from both sides of the Jordan, because there were those who said we can't accept the state if they're going to give us a smaller portion. We have to stand on principle that all of this was promised to the Jews in the Torah. And we spoke about Rav Chaim Ozer, where he was asked this question by Rav Herzog, what do we do if they offer us a little? Can we accept it? And Rav Chaim Ozer said, you know, we're not determining it. If they determine to give us a little, that's, you know, it's not like we choose it. We're getting what they're going to give us. And so he's saying that wasn't the reason why they opposed it, because they opposed, even if they're going to give the Jews everything, these rabbis opposed it. And this is what's even more significant, I think. V'af im tehei b'nuya al yesorot hadat. Even if the state was going to be a religious state, these rabbis were opposed to the creation of a state. Mipnei shezehuk ein kefira be'emunat biyat HaMashiach, because acceptance of a state before the coming of the Messiah is heresy. It's denial of the messianic ideal. It's hard for me to believe that this was Rav Aaron Cutler's opinion or Rechanan Wasser's opinion, as opposed to simply being something they went along with the Hungarians about. Because this is a standard, like Satmar-type Hungarian view. You never, in all the writings of Rav Aaron, where he writes against Zionism, he never mentions this argument of, the classic Satmar anti-Zionist argument. It's all the more practical argument that Zionism is destroying Judaism, but not that, if he never speaks about there being a Jewish state. In my reconstruction of what happened is that you have a group here, they formed a bloc, and when they presented their arguments for all the reasons who were opposed, this was one of the arguments. The Rabbi Chanan, Rav Aaron Cutler were a part of this bloc. That doesn't mean that everything in every bloc put forth by a bloc represents everyone. This is not the Lithuanian perspective, although the Stipor had a view similar to this. But in any event, that's in the bloc that they were a part of. This viewpoint was given. Then they give a second reason, especially since this Jewish state will be built on Yesodot HaKfira and will cause the desecration of God's name. That's what you hear from Rav Chanan Wasserman, that a state's going to be established based on heresy and going to indoctrinate children in heresy. And as we see, Rav Chanan even goes so far as to say the Zionists are going to force the religious to attend heretical schools, just like they did in the Soviet Union. I mean, he was so off on this. But that was the great fear, not just his fear. That was Reb Chaim Soloveitchik's fear. Reb Chaim Soloveitchik thought that when the state was established, you'd have to really be afraid that the Zionists wouldn't kill the religious. So that's the position of the anti. Then it says, the opposition to them, Tanu Kenegdam, who opposed this block of the Czech rabbis, the Hungarian rabbis, and Reb Chanan and Reb Aaron Cutler, that was the Admorim, the Hasidic rabbis, the Beyond, Sadagura, Rav Tsirilson, Nasi HaKnesiah, who is Rav Tsirilson, the president of the conference. Here is a picture of Rav Huleib Tsirilson from an election that, this is the election poster of the Agudas Yisrael in, this would have been in Kishinev, where he was the rabbi of. So the Aguda is running for the seat in the city, because like I said, Orthodox, Agudists, Mizrahi, everyone's running to be on the council. Their rabbi, the rabbi of the city, Rabbi Hudoid Tsirilson, is, he's an Agudist. So here you have his picture. And he was a leading Agudist, a leading member of the Aguda, and they made him president. It's an honorary position, but president of the Knesia Gedola. Who else was opposed to Rabbi Chanan? Harav Levin Mireisha. That's Rav Aaron Lewin, the father of Isaac Lewin and the grandfather of Nat Lewin, and the great grandfather of someone in Lakewood, I'm told. Young Talmud Chacham. But he was the one that, remember, Rabbi Chanan said that we can't have him go speak to the Polish president, because then he speaks such a good Polish, then that'll be lend support to the idea that all rabbis should learn to speak Polish. So these people were in favor of a state. He was actually Rosh Moetzet Gedolei Torah. He was the head of the Moetzet Gedolei Torah. Who else? Rav Sarotskin, Rav Zalman Sarotskin, who later becomes well-known in the Lithuanian world. He's well-known then as well. What did they say? That it is permissible, it is possible. Efshar laskim, l'fi chukei Torah, according to Torah law, we can agree to establish a state of Israel, a Jewish state, they say, in a portion of Israel without denying the messianic idea. And then they say, and we don't need to fear, v'en lachshosh, that the irreligious, they call them the chafshiim, the freethinkers, Yerdefub Medina Yehudit HaDadad. He says, we don't need to be worried that the irreligious are going to persecute the religious, which is what the other position was saying. V'al kein asur l'dchot behechlet dvar Medina Yehudit. Therefore, it is forbidden, as we can't, I mean, we can't oppose the creation of a state. On the contrary, we must argue for the creation of a state. But and we have to argue that it has wider borders. Already in the 30s, there was talk about these tiny borders. What else do we need to do? We need to fight that the constitution of the state of the Jewish state will be on Yesodot HaDat VaMasorah, will be based on Torah. And we have to protest that, in the conferences that were taking place with the British government, they didn't ask the Orthodox to participate. And then what does it say? Those Jews at the those people at the convention who supported the state, they won. The Nitzchu, Omrei Hain. So there was an argument. The vote went for those who support the establishment of a state. The Koach HaTan Nitka, and all the decisions were accepted. And he says, Pardes tells us that viewpoint, the decision of the Moetzes Gedolei Torah on splitting up the land was already published in the previous issue of Pardes. You can look there. Then he goes on. So here you have the agreement of the Moetzes Gedolei Torah. And this is an important historical point, that in 1937, the Agudas Yisrael, which was founded as an anti-Zionist organization, by 1937 it changed its tune and it publicly accepted the creation of a state of Israel and argued that we can not only accept it and argue in support of it, but it is forbidden, they said, to oppose, that is, to adopt the Satmar position and rally and put pressure in opposition to the creation of a state. And the reason is obvious. I mean, you had some who were more Zionistic, but even those who were not such Zionistic, I never heard there of Zalman Sorotzkin was such a Zionist. But we already saw with Reb Chaim Ozer, anyone with sense could see that a state was going to be established. If the Orthodox were going to be in opposition to this, and if the Orthodox were going to be fighting the establishment of the state, and then the state's established, that would be it for the Orthodox. They'd have no place in running of the state. There would you can imagine what the revenge of the irreligious would be. I mean, fund Orthodox schools when the Orthodox fought tooth and nail against the establishment of it. As Reb Chaim Ozer said to Rav Herzog, since the state is coming, it's important that we be there and be part of it. Once it became obvious, there are people in the Aguda high command, as you can call it, who oppose the creation of a state and would prefer it if it didn't come to be. Reb Chaim Ozer himself, as we saw, would have preferred there never would have been a state, and it would have remained as a British protectorate. But once it became obvious that the state was going to be established, it was suicide, they thought, religious suicide, for the Aguda not to get involved with it. Because if you're not there in the takeoff, you will not be there in the landing. And that is what led the way. I mean, if you're going to be a purist like Rav Bochanan or Aharon Cutler, you're not going to accomplish anything in politics. Then it goes on, the report. He tells us that just like there was this dispute, we'll go for 5 more minutes, just like this dispute over the state of Israel, there was another dispute, betoch havada ha'politit shel Agudat Yisrael. That is, the rabbis argued it, and the same dispute took place in the political council. What is the political council? Exactly what I told you. Agudas Yisrael used to actually have two elements to it. It had the lay element, where the lay leaders spoke politics and came to their decisions. And then they brought their decisions to the Moetzes Gedolei Torah and tried to convince them. And there was also the Moetzes Gedolei Torah who met. And here they were actually working simultaneously. And the political group would bring their viewpoint to the Moetzes Gedolei Torah. Today, you don't even have a political group doing things like that. Everything has been given to the rabbis. But that's not how Jacob Rosenheim ran the Aguda in those days. So what was going on? While the rabbis were fighting about their matter, it's like two chambers of Congress here. The politicians were fighting theirs. And who was at the head of it? Uverosham Mar Rosenheim. He doesn't even call him rabbi because he's not. A Reb. Mr. Rosenheim. The Gudman. Who is Gudman? Gudman is Harry Goodman. He's an Agudist deputy, Agudist leader from London. How he got involved in the Aguda, I'm not sure. He was not a Jewishly learned fellow. But he became important in Aguda circles, and before this, before the vote was taken, that is before 1937, Harry Goodman was an anti-Zionist. So they had this debate: who were the ones saying no against the state? Against support for a state, Rosenheim, Goodman, Vahar of Moshe Blau. Moshe Blau was the leader of Agudas Yisrael in the political leader of Agudas Yisrael in Jerusalem. In Israel, you really just had Agudas Yisrael in Jerusalem. And what would become later the Edah Haredit was the rabbinic leadership. You see that the Aguda in Israel, Eretz Yisrael, was very different. It was the Hungarian extremist element, and it was no very different than the Agudist in Germany and Poland. Pardes will say that explicitly soon. His brother is Amram Blau, the famous Notary Carta person. Moshe Blau, who's also a big anti-Zionist, is more mainstream, and when the Aguda changes his position, he falls into line. Who were the ones who said yes in the among the lay leadership? None of these names mean anything, I don't think, to anyone except for Binyamin Mintz. Binyamin Mintz, some of the names I could mention to you were killed in the war. But Binyamin Mintz makes his way to the land of Israel. He's a leader of the Workers' Party of Agudas Yisrael, Pohalei Agudas Yisrael, in the early years of the state. And he is the one who has the great treason. He's the one that breaks with Agudas Yisrael. And the story was the Mootzes Gedolei Torah made a ruling that Pohalei Agudas Yisrael couldn't join the government, and the Pohalei Agudas Yisrael broke with Agudas Yisrael. And if you read, when you're part of an organization and you break with it, the feelings of treason are felt much more strongly. If you read the letters of the Steipur and Rav Shach, the attacks against Pohalei Agudas Yisrael are harsher and stronger than you see against the attacks against the Zionists. Because the Zionists, the Mizrahi, everyone knew that they were outside the fold. But the Pohalei Agudas Yisrael were part of Agudas Yisrael. And when they broke, when they rejected the authority of the Mootzes Gedolei Torah, then the response was severe. No one expected the Mizrahi to listen to the Mootzes Gedolei Torah. They, in the Aguda mind, they were far removed. They were already off the derech, as it were. But for people who knew what Agudas Yisrael was and chose to break with them, the response was very severe. But it didn't bother the Pohalei Aguda. They had their own rabbis, and they did their own thing. So who were the who else were the yeses? Okay, let me read you now the arguments. What did the opponents say? They repeated the arguments you already heard. In the Jewish state, who's going to rule? The Anshei HaSmol. And what are they going to do? The leftists are going to rule. Him yirdefu b'li chemla. They're going to persecute without mercy the Orthodox Jews. They're going to yinalu. They're going to close the doors of Eretz Yisrael. They won't let Orthodox Jews go on Aliyah. This is what they thought was going to happen. They're going to create a socialist paradise there. They're going to persecute the Orthodox Jews who are in the land of Israel, and they're going to close the doors and not let any Orthodox Jews go on Aliyah. Then they go on. The Medina Yehudit tazik liyudei ha'gola. It's going to hurt the Jews living in the diaspora. Actually, I see it's already 10 o'clock, so let me stop here. We'll pick up next time here. These arguments are so far-fetched and so wrong. It's like the arguments these people who opposed it, some of them are on record as saying things like, there will never be a Jewish state. Because, things like that, even when it was obvious. What we want to do next class is, I'm going to pick up here, is we still have a good deal more to do about this conference and this important, important convention. And then we have to move on. Rabbi Chanan, his journey to America. That remains the subject of legends today, his journey to America. And, his return to Europe, the end, and then, of course, his ideas. I see, this is a third, and there's a lot to do with Rabbi Chanan. I see at least we have another three classes. I don't think we'll beat our record here. The record is Rabbi Yitzchak Rav Chaim Ozer, eight classes, and I know we had six for Rabbi Yitzchak Chanan. I think we had six with the Chasam Sofer, but there's so much with Rabbi Chanan because his life encompass all these disputes, and the dispute of the Aguda in 1937 over which direction to support a state or not to support a state. It's so important, I think, and how Pardes did such a service. But before we end, let me show you just a tidbit, which is nice. The very same issue which we're doing right now, 1937, I think it's Elul, no, not Elul, Tish, No, it's 19, it's issue 7. So what it, I forget what issue it is. It's I think it's the last no, I think it's Tishrei. So it's September already, 37. I'll give you the answer right now because wait till you hear this. There'll be some people who will appreciate this, I think. I'm going to get the exact date. Ah, yes. Okay. On page 15 of the September or October, I have to check, issue of Hapardes, you have an announcement. Page 15. Mazel Tov. They say Mazel Tov to our dear friend, the Gaon HaGadol, Yosef Dov HaLevi Soloveitchik Shlita of Beis Din of Boston, and to his wife. Why? For the birth of them, Ben Zachar, a son, LaMazel Tov. The Brit Mila was on Shmini Atzeres. And who came to the Bris Milah? His father, Rav Moshe Levi Soloveitchik. This is an announcement of the birth of Professor Chaim Soloveitchik. I'm looking at Wikipedia right now. He is born September 19th, 1937. So I don't know if he even knows about the birth announcement, but here it is in Apardes, year 11, issue 7, page 15. Okay, let's stop now. I'll take some of the questions. I'm going to read the questions out loud because an email came in that it wasn't clear. What was being said, what was being asked. So I'll read some of the questions. Let me go back. Yaakov Reifman says the greatest Onim in Lithuania at the time were Rav Chaim Elozer, Rav Baruch Be'er, Rav Bochanan, the Brisker Rav, and Rav Aaron Cutler. I'm not going to deny that. What I said is that you might have missed a couple there as well, but Rabbi Aaron Cutler's position did not reflect the Lithuanian position. It was the yeshiva position, and his yeshiva position. I would disagree with I wouldn't disagree with you, but I'd add the Kovno Rav, the Dvar Avraham, was regarded by the masses as the greatest one. The people you gave were Rosh Yeshiva, not Rav Chaim Ozer, but the Rabbi Chanan had no influence outside the yeshiva world. He was a Rosh Yeshiva. Rabbi Baruch Be'er also. If you want to know who was the most influential rabbi in Lithuania at the time, it was Rav Chaim Ozer, and the second most influential was the Kovno Rav. You have to start looking at important rabboning of communities, which you have. You're representing the yeshiva world perspective, but on the ground, who are the influential rabbis? That's something very, very different. Regarding the unholy alliance between the rabbis and the economic elite, the Beis HaLevi stood up for the poor. And there were others who stood up for the poor, and others who said that even my son should be in the draft. But the typical rabbi didn't, and we spoke about this in a previous class. I don't think the typical rabbi had to stand up. If it was every man for himself, who says he's obligated? But it did leave a bad taste in people's mouth, and it fed the anti-clerical feeling. Yaakov says the picture of women with short sleeves. Perhaps they didn't have the ability to create a picture of a firm woman. They just used an existing picture. No, they didn't need to use any picture if they didn't want. They had the ability. Believe me, they had the ability, and they could have. These are drawing. These are artistic drawings. They could have had any woman they wanted. They could have had covered her sleeves. They didn't have to have a woman. That they didn't. I mean, that was the furthest thing from their mind in those days. Rabbi Yaakov tells us that Rav Elazar Silver disparaged Rav Aaron Cutler and Rav Moshe Feinstein. His son was very bitter at the fact that his father was sidelined by Rav Aaron. And he says that he was only at the forefront of Orthodoxy because of his greatness in Torah. He was an interesting personality. He was a leader. He was a lead, he's the founder of Agudas Yisrael, and he was the head of Agudas Rabbanim. So he was a leading figure in American Orthodoxy at the time. He was sidelined later on in the 50s. But until the 1950s, he was a very important figure, and he was involved in all the major decisions of Orthodoxy. Yaakov has a lot to say here. He says, disregarding numerous rabbis when they disagree with you, Rabbi David Carliner wrote in defense of his brother-in-law, Pinhas, when the letter was put in the Chayim by the Jerusalem rabbis. Yes, that's a famous story. He said that okay, I'm not gonna just in the interest of time, I'm not gonna read the whole thing he wrote there, but yes, there's We have plenty of examples of that in the case of Dovid Karliner defending his brother-in-law, Pinhas, who, by the way, was at odds with many things that Dovid Karliner believed, and yet he defended him. I don't see any other questions. Oh, Yaakov says that this Harry Goodman was a Mizrahi person until he was converted to Aguda from Rav Yosef Chaim Zonnenfeld. For the what we're going to see next class is that the Jews of Eastern Europe were very strongly in favor of Zion of a state. These were the ones who felt, as second-class citizens in Poland, Lithuania, and they really were suffering in all sorts of ways. And for them, it was a question of nationalism. They were real nationalists, the typical Balabas in Poland and Lithuania. On the other hand, the West European Jews, the Jews in Germany, France, England, they didn't have these feelings. And from the standpoint of the Jews of the East, someone like Harry Goodman, I mean, they saw him as an assimilationist. They saw him as someone without Jewish pride. You can read comments that people make about him, that he's an Am Haaretz, he has no Jewish pride. And I can understand that, because from their perspective, anyone who would oppose a Jewish state, there's real issues there. Yaakov, let me just say, and I'll end with this, for the masses of Eastern Europe, and this is reflected, as we'll see next time, by their delegates to the Aguda Convention, it was obvious you had to support the creation of a state. This was something which was the not just the majority, this was the overwhelming position of the masses of Jews in Lithuania and Poland, that you need to have a Jewish state, Jews need somewhere to go. The fact that you had some rabbis at yeshivas who had a different position, this was not the position of the masses. The yeshiva world was a tiny segment of Lithuania. The Kovno Rav, who was the guide for the Yavne school system, this was a school system in all of Lithuania for boys and girls. This was the religious school system. It was a Torim Derech Eretz style school system, not the same as in Germany, but Torim Derech Eretz as it is in Lithuania. He is 1,000 times more influential than any of those rabbis you mentioned, other than Rav Chaim Moser Grzinski. He was more influential than Rav Chaim Moser also, by the way. The Kovno Rav was without doubt the most important rabbi in Lithuania. And we're talking about the masses. The yeshivas in Lithuania were much less significant and important than they are today. Today in America, American Orthodoxy is very much influenced by the yeshivas. Everything from the fact that you have these kollels, graduates of these yeshivas come to our communities, they teach in our schools. If you go to Kovno or Vilna, these yeshivas have no influence on the way the masses live. The Rosh Yeshiva were not important. Communal rabbis were important. And so it's a very different world. So if you tell me that these rabbis were greater in learning, that's one thing. I'm not going to, although the Kovno Rav was great in learning also. We're going to do classes, hopefully, on the Kovno Rav. The Kovno Rav represented the orthodoxy of Lithuania of the masses. And it was an orthodoxy that is best seen today, or was best seen by what they tried to establish in Baltimore, in Ner Yisrael. I don't know about the current Rosh Yeshiva, who's very different. But the old tradition of Ner Yisrael was an attempt to recreate and revert what existed in Lithuania, and Rav Ruderman was quite influenced by the Kovno Rav. Everyone worked. Everyone, was part of society. So I'll just leave that at that. And Yaakov, we could take it up, I guess, offline. And if you send me something, I need to, I'll begin with it next class. But we have a lot more to do, and we'll begin next class with what the political leadership of the East European Jews have to say, why we need a Jewish state, and then we'll go on, and we'll even get to next class Rabbi Chanan Wasserman's speech. Rabbi Pardes records Rabbi Chanan Wasserman's speech, and just to give Yaakov, maybe after I just gave him my opinion and rejected his, later on, Rabbi Shmuel Pardes says that Rabbi Chanan Wasserman was unique at the convention. He was head and shoulders above the other rabbis. So even though Rabbi Pardes does not agree with Rabbi Chanan Wasserman, and he tells us that the other rabbis rejected him, he also tells us that among all the rabbis at the convention, Rabbi Chanan Wasserman, Mishichmo Amala, was head and shoulders above all the other ones there, which is, I mean, this is real praise coming from Rabbi Pardes. But we'll pick up with that next class. Good night, everyone.